You are listening to the Vet Podcast, presented by veterinarian Dr. Brian Greger from New Zealand and featuring an international team of animal health professionals. Join us as we discuss pet health issues from around the world.
There is a term that we use called drug compliance. Your vet, or for that matter, your doctor, gives you some medicine and some instructions. Do you follow them? If not, you are not alone. Coming from sunny New Zealand, we don't give it much thought, but ultraviolet light is often lacking in the life of some small pets. And finally, they may look pretty, but some lilies have the potential to kill your cat. As vets, we get the odd case that although we are sure of the diagnosis and the treatment we have prescribed should be working, the animal just isn't improving. It may not be that we have got it wrong. We could be looking at something that is known as poor compliance. Compliance in this case refers to whether the patient has received its medication or not. Surprisingly, in a study reported in the Journal of Small Animal Practice, April 1999, a 10-day course of oral antibiotics was given to 95 owners. Only 44% had 100% compliance. 88% had 80% compliance. In another study carried out at the University of Utrecht, of 57 owners, 40 being companion animals, 17 horse owners, only 52.6% were totally compliant, 17.5% didn't always give the correct dosage, and 7% just didn't give any of the medication at all. And we wonder why our patients don't come right sometimes. This study also examined the factors that increase compliance. The only two that were found were 1, repeating the instructions about administering the medication, and 2, giving verbal instructions on the effects of the medication. Okay then, as veterinarians, how do we improve owner compliance? Firstly, we have to think about how the medication is given. Still the most common method is in tablet or pill form. It may seem basic, but we have to teach our clients how to give tablets. As humans, we weren't born with an innate ability to give tablets to cats and dogs. Drug manufacturers have taken a couple of steps to improve compliance with tablets. The first is to make them palatable. There are a number of medications that the manufacturers claim to have a high level of palatability. And you know what? Some of them actually have. Another is to decrease the frequency they have to be given. There seems to be a trend to formulate drugs that only have to be given once daily. This has been taken to an extreme recently with an anti-arthritis drug that only needs to be given once a month. As with most things in life, there is a compromise with increasing duration. If the animal has side effects to the drug, or the medication needs to be changed for one reason or another, unfortunately, the medication will still be active for up to a month after treatment. Another useful innovation is long-duration antibiotics. In the past, long-acting injectable medications relied on the depot effect. That is, the product sat in a depot in the muscle or under the skin and was slowly absorbed by the body. Most drugs are broken down by the liver, meaning the time it takes for the body to break down the drug, technically known as the half-life, is relatively shorter. Some of the latest drugs have managed to get around this liver metabolism. The one that comes to mind is an injectable antibiotic that gives 2 weeks' worth of antibiotic cover from a single injection. Another advantage comes out of this technology. We use the term MIC, which stands for minimum inhibitory concentration, which is the lowest concentration of antibiotic that kills 99% of the bacteria. With some medications, the level of drug in the body will fall below the MIC between treatment. With the long-acting drugs, this doesn't occur, which technically may give a better therapeutic effect. Another innovation which has been around for a while are slow-release pellets, which are placed under the skin. These have been used for things like temporary chemical castration in dogs. These pellets are placed under the skin much the same as a microchip is inserted. There are a number of factors involved in the successful treatment of a sick animal. Obviously, the first is the correct diagnosis, and then the appropriate medication. From then on, it comes down to compliance. Take note of what your vet tells you as far as the dosage and the frequency of medication. It should be written on the medication. If you don't understand how to give the medication, ask. If you don't think you are capable of giving the medication, let your veterinarian know. There is no point going home and not giving the medication because you were too embarrassed to say. Your vet will either show you how to give the medication or prescribe a different form of medication that will ensure the correct dosage. As a final word, if you are given 7 days worth of medication, make sure you finish it all, even if your pet appears to be better. Many drugs require a full course of medication to be given to ensure the problem doesn't come back. Coming from the Southern Hemisphere, spending much of my life living under an ozone hole, and most of our houses being airy and sun-filled, I haven't given much thought to UV requirements for animals. But in many parts of the world, many pets never see the light of day, so to speak. Richard Grubb joins us from the sun-deprived depths of London. Richard, what is the effect of UV light on the body, apart from causing sunburn and skin cancer?
UV light is required to make vitamin D in the skin, and all land animals and birds can synthesize or make vitamin D when exposed to UV light. And vitamin D is important for bone growth, bone and tooth maintenance in some species, and a few other functions, but it's really to do with the bones.
So if we have got a deficiency of UV light, hence vitamin D, what kind of health issues are we likely to see?
Well, it depends on the species to a degree, but you can get issues with the skeleton in terms of the bone growth. Weakness is there. In reptiles, they'll often become quite weak, unable to stand. There may be issues with shell production for eggs, and behavioural issues as well, particularly in birds. In rabbits and particularly, there can be issues with tooth formation. And lack of vitamin D may contribute to dental problems in rabbits and other rodents with continuously growing teeth.
Okay, so if the sun isn't shining, normally we'll turn the lights on. How much UV light is emitted by normal lights?
Basically none. Normal incandescent bulbs from lights such as you'd have in the house don't produce any UV light at the wavelengths required to make vitamin D in the skin.
So all creatures aren't created equal. I guess there is different requirements for different species of UV.
Yeah, even different groups, particularly focusing on reptiles. We're probably the biggest one you've noticed at most. There are some nocturnal animals, for example, some species that have evolved to live mainly at night, or at least in low light conditions. And obviously those ones aren't exposed to natural UV light very much at all. Predators also, animals that eat other live animals, insectivores and such, get a lot of their vitamin D from their diet, and therefore perhaps don't need quite as much from the sunshine, as opposed to, say, in reptiles, basking species, tortoises and such, who are mainly herbivorous. They need quite a lot of vitamin D because their natural diet is very low in it, and they are usually active during the day where they'd be exposed to quite a lot of the UV.
Now, I'm just thinking, I'm obviously down in the Southern Hemisphere, and we've had this problem with the ozone layer and heaps of UV blasting us all the time. I suppose there will be geographic differences as well, because to be fair, I can't recall ever really seeing any of these kind of species you're talking about coming into my clinic with problems which are contributable to low UV.
I think, yes, certainly not having an ozone layer means a lot more exposure, higher exposure to UV for shorter periods of time. It is perhaps more of a problem in countries with perhaps not quite as good weather, but it's mainly to do with not allowing animals outside or access to the sunlight. Even on a cloudy day, there will be some, and generally enough, UV provision coming through the clouds. So really, I think it's more of an indoor-outdoor than specifically a geographical issue.
Now, we're not going to go into details here of which species require how much UV, but if people have got animals which do fall into these categories that you're talking about, the rodents and the reptiles, where are they best to go to get information on the UV requirements for these animals?
There's a very good website resource for particularly reptile owners on UV guidance and various lights you can use, which is uvguide.co.uk.
let's flip things around the other way, Richard. Are there risks of overexposure? I mean, one of the obvious ones that we see here in New Zealand and Australia are things like squamous cell carcinoma, cancers on the nose and ears of cats. Can you overcook your turtle with UV light?
Yes, I mean, I suppose it would be theoretically possible. The sorts of cancers and tumours that we see perhaps in mammals more with overexposure to UV light are not really seen massively commonly in reptiles, but certainly I think there would be a risk. And the other point to make is very short wavelength, high frequency UV light is actually quite toxic and fatal to a lot of species. So the wavelength of the light is very important. The other thing is there has been some reports of retina damage, eye damage in reptiles with sort of too much UV or UV provided at the wrong level. So yes, there are some dangers.
Okay, now just to finish off, as I've alluded to earlier, in countries with high sun UV levels like New Zealand and Australia, like in New Zealand in the heart of summer, we have these warnings on the weather forecast of, you know, maximum exposure to the sunlight in the middle of the day is 10 minutes before you're going to burn. What can be done to prevent overexposure to UV, just talking about animals in general?
Yeah, there's a few things. Zinc-based sun creams are quite useful in some species, obviously. Need to check the label and make sure it is safe for use on your particular species. But also just even if you are providing UV inside in a tank or a vivarium, providing leafy cover and hides so the animals can get away from the light is a simple thing, but very, very useful. They can then escape if they need to.
That's great. Well, thanks a lot for that, Richard. I'll let you get back to your drab London evening, and I'm going to go out and bask in the warm Southern Hemisphere ultraviolet light. So thanks for your time again.
Don't get burnt.
Oh, no truer word has been said in jest, Richard. Being a former Kiwi, you appreciate just how bright the sun is here. Unfortunately, New Zealand has got one of the highest incidents of skin cancer in humans in the world. Anyway, moving on, we'll catch up again with Scott Arnold, veterinarian from Niagara in Ontario, Canada. Lilies are often kept as pretty houseplants. Unfortunately, not only are they pretty, they can be fatal to cats.
I know most pet owners know about certain toxins in their houses, including chocolate and rat poison. But there's one plant toxin that most cat eaters know nothing about. This is the lily plant. These plants include the daylily, the Easter lily, and the tiger lily, among others. These plants are beautiful to look at. The problem we have is, if your pet chews on any part of the plant, it becomes highly toxic to these cats, and it can become fatal within a short period of time. So what is the problem? The problem is your cat can chew the leaf or the stem, it's an ingested, and it contains a toxin that attacks the kidneys. So what do you expect when your cat eats these plants? Usually your cat will start out drooling, vomiting, it will have a loss of appetite. Over time, it will start increasing urination, but over about 2 or 3 days, it will stop producing any urine at all. This becomes highly fatal. So how do we treat these cats? If you saw them eat the plant, you would rush them to the clinic right away, where the veterinarian will induce vomiting, and then place the pet on high volumes of IV fluids. If you delay in getting to the veterinarian, by the time they get there, the renal damage has already been done. These cats, the prognosis is much more grave. After the volumes of fluid, the vet will keep checking its kidney values to make sure the pet is coming back to normal. The moral of this story is, if you have a cat, you should check and see what kind of plants you have around the house. If you have lilies, you might not want to have them.
You have been listening to The Vet Podcast. You can find us on Facebook, The Vet Podcast app in Play Store, iTunes, Google Play, or bookmark us in your favourite podcast player. To contact us, message through Facebook or email vetpodcast@gmail.com.